welcome everyone to Consumer Choice Radio. We're broadcasting live on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM out of Wilmington, North Carolina. Our website is consumerchoiceradio.com. There you can find all the previous episodes, our show notes, everything that we discuss and talk about week in and week out. We're broadcasting now. It is the 21st day of March in the year 2020, a strange year indeed. And I am Yael Ososki, broadcasting to you right now from Vienna, Austria, in quarantine. And we're also joined here on the line by David Clement out in Toronto. David, sir, how goes it?
Yes, it's going. I mean, trying to hold up. I'm not in quite as formal of a quarantine as you are, but still, I feel a bit like a house cat. never going outside.
I mean, we do have to give praise to all the people who make it possible for us to be able to work online, broadcast online. I mentioned this on Facebook, that we need to be celebrating and cheering all the sysadmins, the developers out there, all the guys that have been just doing such an incredible job keeping the infrastructure of the internet together. I mean, these guys, we just have to applaud them all day long.
Absolutely. They're the real MVPs.
Yeah.
I mean, you have your in-person service workers who, like your doctors and nurses, those people obviously deserve a lot of praise because they're putting themselves at risk. And then behind the scenes, you have the people who are kind of frantically trying to keep everything afloat for the ability to even broadcast on the radio or put a podcast online, or the people who keep the social media platforms running. So they definitely deserve some praise too, because they are helping keep us sane through all of this craziness.
So if you've been kayaking in the wilderness and you don't know much about what we're talking about, we are now facing a global pandemic. We are self-quarantined or quarantined by government diktat in many of our countries and cities and states. I am right now in Austria, which imposed this starting last week. So it is usually, you know, the European countries that tend to go head first, and they follow the Italian example. And this is thanks to COVID-19, also known as the coronavirus, also known as SARS-CoV-2, something like this.
Yep.
And this has been ravishing a lot of people in many communities. Started in Wuhan, China, and now we are facing another week of kind of being enclosed in our homes as basically society and government have come all out, and we've completely shifted gears. We've gone into wartime mode to try to stop this, and everybody's social distancing, David.
Yes. Yeah. I've never experienced ever in my, I mean, there are moments in your life that kind of change how you look at things forever. 9/11 is certainly one of those. Like you kind of remember where you were. For those on the Eastern Seaboard, not quite North Carolina, but north of North Carolina, I think all the way into Virginia, there was a blackout, a 2-day blackout in the middle of the summer. I believe that was in 98, which included my home just outside of Toronto. You remember things like that. This is certainly going to be one of those defining moments for our generation in terms of getting through this, it reconfiguring. I mean, for so many people right now, they're working from home for the first time. You and I have had the pleasure of working remotely for a long time, so this isn't too much of an adjustment for us. I always joke with people that I've been in my pajamas for 5 years, so it's not too much of an adjustment for me.
Yeah.
I think it's
crazy to see is that there, you know, we did, yeah, sure, it's taken its time or whatever, but this is kind of the new normal. And in every country, there are different impositions and restrictions, and every state and every province, it's much the same. In Europe, we're at least 2 to 3 weeks ahead of what's happening in the U.S. right now. So a lot of the imposition, I mean, so today I ventured out for the first time in probably 5 days, which you are you are allowed to do if you are shopping and buying supplies directly that you might need, or you have a legitimate yep. medical reason, or also if you have to go to work. So these are yep. really the only reasons you're allowed to be outside. You're not allowed to be out in groups larger than five people.
Yep.
And you're not allowed to come into contact with anyone apart from if you're at the store buying something or something like this. So very, very strict rules. I was very surprised. I went out with my bicycle. I went out with my gloves. I went out with, a thing to cover my mouth, had my hat on. I was all prepped and ready to go. And I went outside and there's just a lot of old ladies walking around. I was actually baffled at that.
Yeah, it can strike you as a little odd. We had to go to the bank the other day, and there was a gentleman sitting in one of the waiting chairs at the bank to see somebody with an oxygen tank hooked up. And it's like, buddy, you need to go home.
Yeah, and that's what I saw at the grocery store going around is a lot of older women. Older ladies, at least 60s or something like this, who are, from what everything is that we're learning, they are the most vulnerable to coronavirus, yep. to COVID-19. And they're just kind of out and about lollygagging. These are just a handful that I saw.
Yeah.
But still, this entire quarantine is happening because of the risk that's posed to many of these communities. So,
yep.
Come on, guys.
Yeah, and what's
we're not helping being out either, by the way. But
yeah, well, what's interesting is there are people who are trying to help fill the void for some of these elderly folks. Like a mutual friend of ours, Tom Palmer, was putting up notices in his community, basically saying, if you don't want to leave the house and you need something picked up, call his cell phone, let him know, he'll go and pick it up for you. So trying to help these people and ensure that they don't put themselves at any additional risk. And I mean, I think societally, like on a societal basis, everyone is just trying to avoid being Italy. And sure. So there, that's where I think a lot of these crackdowns come from, is we don't want to see that exponential growth in cases where in the matter of 2 weeks, you go from a couple hundred cases to almost, I think we're beyond 36,000, probably closer to maybe 40,000 now in Italy. So it's just everyone's trying to avoid following that that path.
Yeah, and I have friends in Italy right now, and they're a bit fitter than I am, so they've mostly just been doing workouts indoors. but yeah, it's been a lot of people just sequestered and in their apartments and not really able to really go anywhere. Some people who are able to work remotely, as you mentioned, have been able to do so, others not.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's why here we're trying to stay positive. We're trying to, you know, look above, seeing good things that are happening. And I think there are, at the same time as, you know, we might get very sad and anxious and worried about what the next couple of weeks will be. I think there are many reasons to be hopeful. For us at Consumer Choice Center, which produces this program, we've been writing and very busy. I've actually probably been more busy than I usually
yeah.
am. But we've got a good number of posts that our colleagues have been writing and putting together. David, you want to go through some of those that some people have been writing and publishing and putting together?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
As he opens his tab and goes into the browser.
Yeah, I just gotta pull this up. I mean, it's funny because we're in a interesting position because so many of our colleagues, especially Bill, write so often and so frequently that it can be quite difficult to actually keep track because they're just a machine out there in terms of what they're publishing.
That's true. And we've got a post here related to gene editing by our colleague Fred. We have, you know, sort of a nice self-help guide about all the great things that we now have access to that we have thanks to great applications, to tech firms, to wonderful services now online that we can use as we're sequestered and quarantined in our homes. There's one article I wrote about millennials and retirement accounts. I have seen a lot of panic people who usually are terrible with money, and people talking about selling and do all this. And it's like, look, this is not the time. You know, if there's something that's happening and you're kind of panicking, this is never a time to touch your money and make any large financial decisions. You know, if anything, it's about saving. It's about getting the, as Dave Ramsey would say, the emergency fund, making sure that's piled up and you're able to purchase things when necessary.
It's a good point in terms of purchasing things when necessary. I think that goes back to some of your media hits from this week about alcohol delivery, because that would certainly be a nightmare. I know for me, and I know for many of our listeners, if you were to run out of alcohol in the middle of a quarantine. And I'll let you explain the nuances of alcohol delivery in the states that allow it and the states that don't. But yeah, it's an interesting time in terms of some of the regs on whether or not you can actually have alcohol delivered to your house.
Yeah, and this is we'll be putting out an infographic here very soon. But essentially, if you look at the breakdown throughout the United States of America, Alabama, Oklahoma, Utah ban all shipments of alcohol to consumers.
That's wild.
There are many other states that do allow wine shipments only. There are those that only allow you to have alcohol shipped if you've physically purchased it in the store and you just arrange a delivery. Yeah. And then sometimes it's only wineries in state that you're able to order from. The places where it's totally free include Arizona, Florida, Hawaii, Nebraska, and New Hampshire. So these are kind of the ways that are leading it. And then in North Carolina, that was kind of the point. There was an article in the Carolina Journal by John Trump, who we've spoken to before, not on this program, but on Joe's program on Fridays. And there were thinking about the question of what you can do in North Carolina. So you can get some beer delivered. You can get some wine delivered. Liquor is a no-no. Because of the liquor monopoly here in the state of North Carolina. So that's a no-no. However, other states are taking a cue. They see that we're in a type of crisis mode, and there are things we need to change. So I actually just caught this before we got on the phone here, David, or on the program. This is from Maryland. So this is the governor who's speaking at a press conference.
Oh, nice.
I am issuing an executive order today allowing for delivery and carry out sales of alcohol by bars, by restaurants, bars, distilleries, and wineries, subject to local liquor laws and local regulations. We're doing this to help small businesses and restaurants and to protect vulnerable people from having to leave home. But I want to urge people to be responsible and to avoid large crowds in stores.
Yes, good man. Oh, good man. So that's it's in Maryland. Maryland is not as bad as North Carolina or Pennsylvania, but they still have a lot of restrictions. And very good to see. I mean, come on, this is this is probably going to be one of the most interesting parts of everything that's happening right now, is the number of laws that are being eased, that are being taken away, that are being stripped away. I mean, probably the best example is that finally we're allowing medical practitioners to practice across state lines.
I know. And so many, like, if you see the reactions on Twitter, people will be like, wait, hold on. They couldn't do that before?
Yeah. It's like, and welcome, like, to the world that we've been fighting, you know, the war that we've been fighting for a long time.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you're now one of us. Welcome.
First time.
And so there's this long list of regs that are just basically being ripped apart, and it's up to people like us and people who listen to our show and people who care to make sure that they don't re-implement these silly laws after the fact. Because I would argue that if these laws are silly during a crisis or a pandemic, they're probably silly for ordinary everyday life as well.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Prime Now. Actually, speaking of Prime Now, my favorite tweet so far was from a politics reporter at BuzzFeed. He basically tweeted that a bar in his neighborhood is delivering entire liters of pre-mixed margaritas for $25, and for every liter, you get a complimentary roll of toilet paper.
Wow. There you go. Good marketing.
Exactly. Yeah, perfect. The market provides. There you go. Not only do they now get home delivery from this restaurant. They're throwing in some toilet paper as well as a nice little added bonus.
And, you know, this will be a huge boon to many of these industries that are able to ship into restaurants, and it is important to support them. We got fresh bread delivered this morning. Big, nice German roll. What else did we get? And then I actually have some great, this is a bit, you know, a bit of a delicacy, but I've got a couple racks of ribs arriving tomorrow. I've got a nice couple big slabs of pork that are coming. That's the smoke on the barbecue. But, you know, we were able to get this stuff, and maybe next week I'll order a couple beers, you know, get that in the mail. These are the kind of things that, you know, we kind of are forced to do now that we can't really go out. But glad to see that the restrictions are being lifted in many places. Here's an article from Law 360 about Michigan. In tandem with a statewide emergency effort to stem the spread of COVID-19, Michigan's marijuana regulator announced Monday it would begin allowing medical and adult use cannabis distributors to offer home delivery services and temporarily drive-through sales.
Beautiful, beautiful. Actually, this is something that I've been arguing in favor for in Canada nationally since legalization began. Right now, there's only two provinces that allow for same-day delivery from retailers. And then there are some nuances where, like Ontario, you can pay for next-day delivery, but only if you order online through the government's website. So nothing through actual retailers. So it's nice to see the legal cannabis industry get some love in terms of regulatory easing during this crisis.
And you put together a nice map, David, showing the difference between the Canadian provinces. So we have that over on consumerchoicecenterradio.com. You're listening to this program. We're broadcasting on the Big Talker 106.7 FM. David, we totally forgot to mention, we've got an interview coming up.
We do. I had the pleasure of chatting with Steve Forbes, the editor-in-chief and chairman of Forbes Media, a great friend of the show, a passionate advocate for pro-liberty ideas. And so it was great to sit down with him, talk to him about what the federal government should do in response to the crisis, what the Fed should do, what good policy looks like in this unusual time. And so, he's such a brilliant guy. And so his insights on all of this are always very much appreciated.
Nice. We'll get to his interview in about 10 minutes or so after we hit through the links and go through more of the topics that we're talking about. We are going to do a little bit of experimentation. So those of you who usually listen live to the program, thank you so much for doing that. Those of you who are listening after the fact, you've subscribed to the podcast version. Again, that's also available on consumerchoiceradio.com, on Spotify. You can get through your Apple Podcast, Overcast, whatever you use. And, in the era of being experimental, while we're all quarantined in our homes, if you do subscribe to the podcast, you will get a special edition that we will be live streaming. And we live streamed this yesterday. I'm playing with the time here. Live streamed yesterday, so you will have that. That will be coming into your podcast feed. So please go to consumerchoiceradio.com. It won't be going out on the air, but it'll still be going in our feed. It'll be available on the website. We'll be talking to all of our colleagues at Consumer Choice Center as we're all, again, quarantined in our homes, getting updates on some of the topics that we're interested in, things that we're working on, and really how everyone's doing and surviving and living through this. This is a very interesting moment for human history. I think this is the time that we can use to shine. This is the time that, we can really show the best parts of what our societies are. So do tune in for that and pay attention to the podcast feed. We got plenty coming up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One question I had for you, Yael, I'm interested to get your take on this. So the Trump administration is now fiddling with the idea of mailing checks, $1,000 checks to citizens. I think it's citizens and residents, but I'm not sure. And that begs the question, was Andrew Yang right all along?
Okay, I knew you would ask that. when I think, I mean, this is definitely the moment to play this.
I am once again asking for your financial support.
But what we have with this talk of the stimulus package for everyday people, they, you know, if they were smart, they can take my free advice here, government. They'd call it the Main Street bailout.
Yes.
Something like this. You know, because there are going to be future bailouts at the federal level, let's just be honest.
Yeah.
As much as, you know, we put out press releases and advocate against them, it's going to happen. If they were just to use the messaging and say, look, we're, this is a to help out Main Street, to help out you and your family, Joe Sixpack, it'd be better. Look, was Andrew Yang right all along? I'm not sure, because this is different. This would be a one-time thing, a one-shot payment. What we're hearing now, and the Senate has been working on a version of this, the House has been working on this, all the lawmakers, and by the way, there are now two congressmen who've tested positive for COVID-19, so we'll see what happens. But apparently they're doing remote voting. So it would be apparently $1,000 for adults and $500 for each child.
Yeah, and I mean, that is a lot. I don't really like the word stimulus, because that type of payment in an emergency like this really isn't a stimulus package. It's more
relief.
It's more of just income support, right? Because so many people are going to have either no wages or depressed wages as a result of what's going on. So it's more just to keep people afloat while we figure out what to do. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see if the case for continued payments pans out, if there's any efficacy here, and if it could be a case study for what folks like Andrew Yang advocate, which is a universal basic income.
To answer your question, because I didn't really do that, but I think it's very different, because in a Yang situation, if Yang were president and he got more than the 0.2% that he got, then essentially every American would plan on receiving that $1,000 every month, and they would kind of build that into their budgeting and into their life, and they would keep that in mind. It's like, okay, well, I don't need to work 60 hours. You know, I can do a bit less, and I can spend more time with my family, or I can, you know, purchase X or Y. So I don't know. It would be very different, because the entire idea of Andrew Yang's UBI is the robots are coming for our jobs, and this is going to help really with that mitigation. Now we're actually dealing with the situation that we need to mitigate, and it is hitting hard. The last study I saw showed that 18% of U.S. households are facing either reduced hours or they've been laid off, which is huge.
Yeah, that's a pretty baffling number in terms of.
I don't know if layoff is the right term, or it would be furloughed. You know, essentially, if things do wrap up and the restrictions are gone, these people that are already trained, they could be hired again.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And I mean, some of it could just be like underemployed. So like a restaurant that is now offering delivery, they're not going to have the same amount of delivery drivers as they do servers and bartenders.
Yeah.
So folks are going to have their hours cut, or have very few hours, or not be working at all, things like that. So I definitely think the prospect of a payout directly to people, if we're giving anybody money, is the best way to go. And I know that you've talked about this publicly a little bit in terms of airlines and their request for bailout money, because obviously they're getting beat up pretty bad. What were some of your suggestions, as opposed to money from the federal government, that could help revive the airline industry once we get a hold of COVID-19?
So there are still flights that are happening, obviously reduced. If you've seen on your social media, anyone who's taken a plane in the last week, it's pretty empty. There was one of Johan Nyberg, the Swedish writer and economist. I don't know why he's in the U.S., but he's like on a bunch of flights, and he's like the only dude on there.
Yeah.
So yeah. So the request has come for $50 billion. This is the various U.S. airlines. They've come to the government and asked for $25 billion in low interest or no interest loans, and $25 billion just in a pure handout. you know, there's actually a contrary argument that I'll bring up, but I see this as a bad idea. You know, these airlines, if they're operating on such thin margins that they're not able to weather a week and a half, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, however long it'll be in the beginning of what's happening, you know, their business models are not working correctly. And if we really want to try to do that, we have to think about how do we spark the idea of travel again once restrictions are lifted. And the only way you can do that is to make prices cheaper for every single passenger. So One good idea is to remove some of these duties, some of these taxes. I have to bring up this list of all these taxes that are on there. There's the September 11th fee that goes to pay for security. That's one. You have the passenger landing tax. I mean, you just got a huge amount. Some airlines like Spirit actually do show you when you buy it what the government cut is. That's one idea. Another is allowing competition. So allowing more of these airlines to compete globally, allow them to merge with global airlines, Australian Airlines or British Airways or Lufthansa or something like that. Definitely something could happen there. Because of existing laws, we can't do that. And another one is, let's privatize our airports. I mean, our airports are owned usually by some type of public authority set up by cities or states or tri-state areas, and they don't do a very good job. I mean, if you travel anywhere outside the U.S. and you go to any airport, it's a huge improvement. I think that alone would be able to provide additional funds. The whatever relationship or contract they would have with the airlines would be renegotiated. Maybe it would allow them more of a cut. Maybe the airlines themselves would run the airports and they could be more efficient. I don't know, but there are a lot of regulations, and since we're in regulation cutting mode, I think that's a way better way to do it than just handing out cash. Now, speaking of that, there is the opposite view taken by another friend of the show, Tim Andrews. He's got an article in townhall.com. Let's actually look this up real quick. So he's making the argument that because the government is the one making the restriction, it should be a kind of hand up. So basically, he's saying that it is a private property rights argument, that essentially the government restrictions on travel are affecting the airline industry disproportionately, and that really we should not be totally opposed to it, if I understand his argument.
Interesting. And I won't go too much into some additional thoughts on this because it's about to be discussed in my interview with Steve Forbes, but there is also the prospect of offering above market price loans to these airline industries so that it isn't free money, so that the solvent companies can stay solvent. The ones who are poorly run obviously have to restructure and take it from there. But I'll let Steve, who is much better at explaining those things.
All right. Very excited to introduce our guest today. Steve Forbes is the editor-in-chief and chairman of Forbes Media. He has spent much of his life talking about the ideas of liberty, talking about markets, really breaking things down for consumers. And so we're very excited to have Steve on the show. Thank you very much, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
Ed, good to be with you. Thank you.
Great. So, I mean, obviously, we first have to talk about the elephant in the room, which is coronavirus. I hope that you are holding up nicely and social distancing and making sure that you're staying safe.
So far, so good. I'm doing much better than the markets.
Okay. Yeah, actually, on the markets, I mean, how bad have things gotten? What's your take on this? How do you see the federal government's response? I mean, I know that they've really talked about cracking open the treasury and the possibility of industry bailouts to airlines. Where do you see this going?
Well, I think the key to stemming the panic and getting some confidence back again, part of it will come obviously when we have tests on a sufficient scale to be able to gauge the severity of this thing. And the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, really botched the testing, so we're only getting them now. Mm-hmm. Whereas other countries like South Korea did it weeks ago.
Yep.
Till recently, South Korea would do in a day more than we had done altogether in a month and a half. So, but on the policy side, on the financial side, we have a liquidity crunch.
Mm-hmm.
Money markets are seizing up. And so there are two basic responses. On the commercial side, the Federal Reserve finally is reinstituting a facility it had back in the crisis of 2008-2009.
Mm-hmm.
That enables, the Fed to buy commercial paper, which is short-term borrowings by companies.
Yep.
It's over a $1 trillion market. And money market funds are the biggest buyers, major buyers of commercial paper. They're under pressure because people are scrambling for cash. So that new facility should be buying paper from solvent companies.
Yep.
But it also should be tasked with making loans to otherwise solvent companies, particularly the airline industry, to get them through this liquidity crunch. And so the airlines, for example, the major ones, were all very profitable.
Yep.
Until the crisis. So they come in with collateral, and they make take short-term loans. The interest rate should be above the market rate. So these companies use other sources before they turn to this Fed facility.
Yep.
But when they turn to it, they get the liquidity they need to survive. For smaller businesses, the Federal Reserve should be telling banks, since they're the major bank regulator, to not get caught up on covenants. And if you have local borrowers who were otherwise solvent before the crisis, make sure they have the wherewithal to survive the crisis.
Yep.
It won't go on forever.
Yep.
And if you do that so that the market doesn't seize up, you don't have a panic in the money market funds, you don't have banks hoarding cash because they know companies are going to be drawing down their lines of credit, you'll avoid a lot of trouble. On the individual side, you do something that normally I would disapprove of, but this is an emergency,
mm-hmm.
and that is you give checks of $1,000 to most people. That's not stimulus for the economy. That is a form of insurance to enable people who now suddenly, through no fault of their own, find themselves out of work or under a reduced hours.
Yeah.
To be able to make basic payments, mortgage payments, car payments, the normal household bills.
Of course.
And you make this tax free.
Yeah.
Then you also do a holiday on the payroll tax, what we call FICA.
Yeah.
And that does two things. One is for people who are working, their pay goes up, which is helpful in paying bills.
Yeah.
And for employers, it reduces the cost of labor.
Yeah.
Right now, if you have somebody on the payroll making, say, $50,000 a year, that person is costing you in payroll taxes $3,800. If that is suspended for a while, suddenly the cost of that person goes down without cutting that person's pay.
Yeah.
So these are short-term measures. Yes, these are short-term measures. They're not permanent. It's not like expanding food stamps or leave or all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
This is one shot dealing with the immediate problem. And the nice thing is when the crisis is over, these programs go away.
Yeah. And do you have any concern? This is always the concern among those who kind of care about the ideas of liberty, the concern that when government enacts some of these programs, they tend to either go away very, very slowly in the long term or never go away. Do you have any concerns about that?
That's why you stay away for now from making changes in family leave, you know, what companies qualify and things like that. You don't do those kinds of things. You just do these emergency measures. The nice thing about a check, it's one time.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Nice thing about a payroll tax holiday. It's after a certain date, it's over.
Yeah.
Remember, we did it in 2011, 2012. We cut off 2 points on the payroll tax for working people.
Yep.
And after 2 years, it expired. So you do these things that are just for the immediate crisis. And the nice thing about borrowing from this new facility, if you're a major company, is that because you're paying an above market interest rate, you have every incentive when things start to recover to pay those loans down.
Yeah.
Because you can probably get them cheaper in the market.
As opposed to what you see, I think a lot of people are inclined to push for very, very low interest loans or almost free loans as part of these stimulus packages. But obviously, as you're explaining, the negative repercussion to that would be in the terms in which they would actually pay them back. Is it correct to say that if these loans from government are above market, it gives them some relief, but not free relief in the context of
it keeps them alive.
Yeah.
Because these were not business mistakes they made. They were doing very well before the crisis.
Yeah.
But to make sure you don't have unnecessary collateral damage.
Yeah.
You don't want every airline going bankrupt and selling planes in a distressed market. It just is chaotic.
Of course.
And again, short term. And that way you would deal with the immediate problem. Presumably, in a month or two, we'll have our hands totally wrapped around this virus so we can make decisions based on fact, not on fear or models. We can deal with the real world.
Of course.
And this thing will unwind. And the danger of going directly to industry, which Treasury seems to want to do, making direct loans to, the airline industry, when you're picking one industry over another. So, that becomes politics, whereas with the facility at the Fed, it's industry neutral. Any company under stress can come in and make the case that they should get a loan. Otherwise, you know, they're otherwise solvent. And this way they can get the needed relief and not go into forced unnecessary liquidation.
And how do you see the kind of Saudi Russia oil feud and the price of oil plummeting? How do you see that impacting?
Well, the nice thing is once we get over this crisis and the U.S. economy starts to rev up again, assuming we haven't done something stupid in the meantime like raising taxes or crushing businesses with regulations, is that the U.S. will resume a 3% growth rate. And plus, and other countries will start to say, well, before the coronavirus crisis, the U.S. was doing well. We weren't. What were they doing that we weren't doing?
Yeah.
I.e., we were cutting regulations and reducing taxes. Remember in the 80s, when Reagan did his big tax cuts and some deregulation here, within a few years, 50 countries around the world cut their taxes.
Yeah.
So success begets success. And when you have a more healthier world economy, oil demand will go up, and so will oil prices. What you see now is two countries that should know better pursuing policies for their own internal reasons that are absolutely destructive, not to the to themselves.
Yeah.
They're destructive to themselves. For example, Russia's budget is in desperate condition if oil goes below $50 a barrel.
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia has a low cost per barrel, you know, $3 or $4 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But they have a huge budget for keeping the populace happy and keeping the vast royal family happy.
Yeah.
So they need a higher oil price.
Yeah.
Now, the reason the Saudis are behaving the way they are is the crown prince, who's supposed to be running things these days, he may not be in a position to make a decision to raise the price by reducing output. A couple of weeks ago, he purged members of the royal family.
Yeah, there's definitely internal.
That he may have, he may have internal problems, political problems. So he may not be in a position to do it and look like he's caving into the Russians. And the Russians, not understanding real markets, don't realize that you can't control the price of oil like you can a spigot with water. And they have to ultimately reduce output and get that price up, or otherwise they're going to have severe budget problems.
Yeah, and
which means the populace is not going to be very happy.
Of course, of course. Do you see some of those budget issues leaking into kind of sub-sovereign states in North America? Like I can think of one example of Alberta in Canada and Newfoundland and Labrador in Canada, who are particularly, their budgets are particularly dependent on taxes from the natural resource sector, predominantly oil. So do you see some of that budget crunch coming the same way to U.S. states beyond the coronavirus question, but just mostly from the plummeting price of oil?
Well, I think, could you repeat that?
I'm just asking if you see some of those budget issues happening.
Yeah, in Canada, especially with Alberta, which is dependent on very much higher oil prices than we have today.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be hurt. And I think Canada will do what it can to, keep things going until this crisis passes.
Yeah.
So the sooner that we get our arms around this virus, and I wrote a piece a couple of days ago pointing out that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention really botched this situation. We should have had tests weeks ago, as South Korea and others did. So we could have gotten a better handle on the scope of this thing and what responses were necessary. We're about a month late, 6 weeks late. So eventually we'll learn in the next couple of weeks as these tests come. You know, the numbers will look alarming because we'll actually know who has it. Right now we don't. Because we don't have the tests. So once you get information, once you get facts, then you can start to deal more sensibly with them, instead of shooting here, shooting there, and not knowing what will work and what won't work.
Yeah, and so on that recovery side of things, so looking kind of down the road to when we do have a handle on coronavirus and can deal with some of these other issues, how long do you think, barring any major policy errors, how long do you think it's going to take the markets to actually recover to their pre-coronavirus?
Well, if it looks like we haven't done something crazy, you know, after 08, for example, the Federal Reserve went on this quantitative easing thing, which hurt the credit markets.
Yeah.
Obama put in tax increases, gummed up the healthcare industry. So we had the worst recovery from a sharp downturn almost in American history. Usually after a downturn, you get a sharp pickup, and then you wonder if you can sustain it, but at least you get the sharp pickup.
Yeah.
Didn't happen. So if we avoid those kind of mistakes this time, we should initially get a sharp pickup. People will start to go to restaurants again. Restaurants will start hiring again, and things will start to recover. The energy industry will take longer, but markets try to anticipate the future. And if markets see that things are going to get back on a more even keel and prosperous keel, they'll price that in now.
Of course.
In anticipation. So that's the situation. And so if we don't make those mistakes, the recovery will be should be good. But if we do make mistakes, it's like you have pneumonia, so you go out and sit in the snow. No, not a good idea.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So if you were at the helm and you could make three or four kind of immediate decisions to help speed up or ease the recovery process, what would your major suggestions be?
Well, on the individual side, do the payroll tax holiday to year end. do the $1,000. And I'd also include, which won't happen, a reduction in the capital gains tax
mm-hmm.
to also help the market. Remember, stocks are owned by 401ks, tens of millions of people.
Yeah.
Stocks are owned by pension funds. Now, it's true pension funds and 401ks don't pay tax immediately, but equities are priced at the margin.
Yep.
And if you lower the capital gains tax and you have a recovering economy, equities will respond. And on the corporate side, aggressively move forward with that facility that the Fed is setting up.
Yep.
And make sure you don't have unnecessary casualties there. Make sure you don't have too many necessary casualties on the smaller business side. And then when things start to recover, you pull back. You know, when you start to recover, you don't keep taking antibiotics.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Once you've solved the problem, don't keep taking the medicine. And I mean, that actually kind of highlights some of the nuances of American, or I mean, for most countries, domestic policy. Is a crisis like this really highlights the importance of not overspending when times are good, because it makes it so much difficult when times are bad. And as we've seen increasing spending and expenditure over several administrations. Now, do you think there's any appetite in DC for, is there anybody left who is going to make that case to really calm spending once things do pick up?
Well, the way you have to calm spending is one, you reform, which is beginning to happen, the procurement system in the Defense Department.
Yeah.
Where if you make basic changes, you can easily save $25-30 billion a year.
Yeah.
Which adds up over time.
And are you talking and like on, bidding processes and things like that?
Yeah, yeah, there are a lot of things.
Okay.
In fact, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, a little over 4 years ago, the Pentagon did a major study how they could reform this. And amazingly, they did a pretty good job, came up with a long report. And suddenly the empire inside struck back. You can't find that report online anymore. But that outlined pretty much of the nitty gritty that you have to do. Now, in defense, number three person in the Defense Department, a woman named Lisa Hirschman, has already saved over $10 billion with low-hanging fruit through reforms. So you do that. Now, the big ones, of course, are Social Security and health care, you know, Medicare and Medicaid.
Of course.
On Social Security, the normal economy, we have enough resources to meet the current benefits.
Yep.
For people who are on the system or are going to go on the system the next 10 or 15 years. The real problem is with younger people. And with them, you put in a new system where a chunk of their payroll tax goes to their own personal accounts.
Okay.
Proper regulations. But the thing is, you own them. And even if you have no money in the stock market, you will have more in retirement benefits than you will with the current Social Security system. So you start that. And so young people suddenly realize their labor is producing a thing called capital, and they're not going to want policies pursued that are going to undermine the value of what their labor created.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you do that,
sure.
and as people like me go to our ultimate reward, the old system phases out and the new system predominates.
Yeah.
And you go from a system that is eating capital to one that is creating capital.
Yeah.
And then on the health care, you put in reforms to put the patient in charge again.
Yep.
And those unfunded liabilities go down exponentially because they're based on 75-year calculations. There's no reason why health care costs should be ballooning. We've already seen with things like LASIK surgery,
yep,
where costs are about 30% less than they were 10 or 15 years ago. You see it with cosmetic surgery. You've seen no kind of the medical inflation you've seen elsewhere.
Yeah.
Once you get a true market and effective safety nets, we do it with food stamps. So, you know, nobody's going to go without.
Of course.
You have a vibrant entrepreneurship, and there's a yeah. lot of things coming to be able to do things on your own and your house, and you'll see a much healthier healthcare system.
Yeah.
So you
yeah.
do it a positive way. You don't try to take things away from people.
Of course.
Change what caused the problems in the first place.
Yeah. And I think on that healthcare note, focusing on choice and competition to allow those yes. competitive forces to really drive down prices. I know that we've certainly seen those in the two examples that you gave. It would be great to see that across the board for all sorts of treatments, whether they be very serious and in the space of things like treating cancer and serious illnesses that are possibly terminal, all the way to things like replacing or fixing an MCL tear in your knee. Having that choice and competition would be a huge, huge benefit for consumers who at the end of the day are patients and really focusing on that. So thank you again, Steve. It's been great to chat with you. Always love your insights on how things are going and your thoughts on what should be done at the federal level and things like that. So we really appreciate you joining us. Our listeners are going to certainly love hearing your thoughts. And yeah, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, David. Awesome. Appreciate it.
Welcome back, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Steve Forbes. You are listening to Consumer Choice Radio, broadcasting every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. on the Big Talker FM, 106.7 FM out of Wilmington, North Carolina. Great interview with Steve. I mean, he always has so much to say in terms of his approach to what the federal government should do. So I find it very often hard to disagree with him, even if my first instincts are to disagree with him, but definitely a great interview. We hope to have him back on the show again down the road.
A true American icon.
Yes, yes, exactly. And for someone who, I mean, a lot of people don't know this, but we've known Steve for quite a while and have been at various events with Steve. Just a super interesting, super nice guy, great guy to chat with. And for someone with as much prestige as he is always a pleasure to talk to and have around. So again, thank you to Steve for joining us, and I hope you guys enjoyed listening to his thoughts on the various topics of COVID-19, the Russia-Saudi oil war, and what the federal government would do if he was in charge for the U.S. economy.
And he did run for president. You know, it could have happened.
He did.
I mean, he was yes. very much, you know, a Trump figure back in the day, not with the ideas, but just coming from the business world. So, yep. yeah, awesome to get him on. We're expanding our Rolodex of friends of the show. So yes. we look forward to many more interviews in the coming weeks. I mean, this is a radio program. We're trying to reach out to the public. We need public faces and voices. So perfect. Dave, we've got 5 minutes here on the clock before we have to go to the affiliates. Interesting article here on Axios. Timeline, the early days of China's coronavirus outbreak and cover-up. Now, for those of you who've been following this from the beginning, and I mean, go back to probably our first episode or second episode, we should have, yep. I think we definitely talked about coronavirus and the Wuhan and everything that happening
sure
there.
Did.
And what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is trolls, paid trolls that actually have government positions at some kind of China ministry. They've been very active on Twitter trying to put out this conspiracy theory that the Wuhan virus, the Chinese communist virus, was somehow cooked up in a U.S. military lab and was deployed in China, you know, as a weapon against China, and that's where it all started. This is yeah. the kind of thinking, and this is what the Chinese media is reflecting. This, you have a lot of the people who are now in normal mainstream media who kind of pick up on this and then try to go after Trump for calling it the Chinese virus. I mean, it's definitely crazy, but this article in Axios has a great timeline of showing when the first People started getting ill with coronavirus back in December. You have the number of doctors who were trying to sound the alarm but were shut down by the regime. Yep. There's even the cases of the early tests kind of being ordered destroyed. I mean, it is actually insane what this totalitarian regime has done, and now they're weaponizing this stuff in the media, and people are actually discussing this openly that, oh, you know, it might be done in some U.S. military lab. It is just insane. This is the foreign interference that we heard about with the Russia stuff. This is happening now with China. I mean, come on.
Yeah, and we can see it in real time. I mean, the New York Times just released a video that aggregated all of the tweets from official Chinese government sources, and it basically showed that their first goal was to highlight all of the positives from the outbreak. So all of these puff pieces on things that for the most part turned out not to be true. The second was to show the Chinese government as some sort of world leader in terms of collaborating with international parties and global health organizations to fight the virus. And then the third is to dispute the origin of the virus, and to insinuate that, I mean, one of the conspiracies that they've pushed is that it was that it originated with U.S. Spy agencies or some nonsense like that, and that it didn't stem from Wuhan and didn't stem from pangolins and animal markets and that type of thing. And so it's such a crazy conversation. I think the best way it can be summed up is from a tweet from the World Health Organization, and this was on January 14th. And the World Health Organization tweeted, and I file this under tweets that have aged poorly. So this tweet says, "Preliminary investigations conducted by the Chinese authorities have found no clear evidence of human-to-human transmission of the novel coronavirus identified in Wuhan, China."
What garbage.
Yeah. So you have Chinese authorities who are obviously lying. You have the World Health Organization, who is supposed to be the organization that ensures crazy things like this doesn't happen, taking their word for it. And think about the negative repercussions as a result of that. I mean, you and I were in Europe and Switzerland around the time of this tweet. Just think about what wasn't being done when Chinese authorities said, oh, well, it doesn't transfer human to human, so we're good, we got it, it's under control.
This is just massive craziness. We're going to link to this in the show notes, definitely. Yeah, we'll be talking about this for a long time, I think.
Yeah, it's just genocidal stupidity. It's ridiculous. And yeah, we can talk about, I mean, how people can be critical about how Trump has handled this, but let's not let Trump hysteria distract us from the real problem, which is the fact that the Communist Party in China tried to save face. They eliminated journalists who spoke out about this. They lied to World Health Organizations, and then they enacted the most draconian crackdown probably seen in, I would argue, the last 150 years. And so it's just been an absolute nightmare. And I think it's definitely appropriate to point out that the Communist Party is in large part responsible for how crazy things have gotten.
That is very true. And we'll continue cataloging that for you. And definitely we'll have on some people to discuss that in the coming weeks. Thanks again for listening to Consumer Choice Radio. We're at consumerchoiceradio.com. I'm one of your hosts, Yael Lisowski, broadcasting to you from Vienna, Austria. David, a pleasure to talk to you once more.
Yep, another great week. We'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you then, everybody.